is side three. Let's continue on your DuPont career, John. Are there any other projects that you particularly recall that other fibers that you worked on? Or
I spent a year in Central Research, and that was back in about 1965 or so.
That's right.
And then I worked on some polyhedral Borane chemistry. It was too expensive to be considered for fibers. We made some films from it, but it simply wouldn't make the grade as any industrial use. We explored a number of possibilities.
Was that Merle Mutertes was the Borane chemist?
Yeah.
But that was, were you involved at all with him on that? Or was
no, that was Sharkey was the supervisor, and Von Engelhardt was the associate director at the time. Or was he? I think it was Engelhardt, but it might have been Bert Pratt. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure by the time I came to Central Research in 64, Bert, I think, was an administrative assistant or something.
He may have been,
so
right.
Probably Engelhardt.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a... That period was sort of the beginning of the interchange between Central Research and the operating department.
Right. So I spent a year
I
over
recall
there
up to then the operating department's research laboratories were pretty independent and didn't interact a great deal with Central Research.
Right.
Was that your feeling?
Except that we did sponsor projects in Central Research, and the people that were on projects would come over to pioneering research and report on what they were doing. And I think Charch operated this project system fairly well, because he would have people come over after the period that they had sponsored, especially when they're asking for more money to continue sponsorship, and they would give a report on it. And at that time, he felt that after 6 months that something practical should be on the horizon, otherwise he didn't feel inclined to support it again. And so when they asked for money and they would put up forth their various plans, he would ask a very leading question. He would say, well, just suppose that you succeeded in doing all of these things that you plan to do. Where would you be then? How would it show any potential for giving us a new product? If they couldn't answer that very positively, the chances of continued support were very slim. Charch was a very bright fellow and could see where things were going. And so he would encourage people, but still he had that industrial background and viewpoint that had to be satisfied when you began to spend more money on the project and increase the personnel particularly.
Now, you had a 3-month period, a quarterly report that you had to write on each project?
Back in those days?
Back when you first came.
I think that's right. We had to write 3 or 4 reports. I think it was 2 to 3 reports a year. At that time, Central Research had 4 reports a year. But that, of course, has gone the other way around now. Central Research writes fewer reports, and Pioneering continues at least, supposedly, at least 2 reports a year.
Yes, fine.
And they give quarterly oral reports about every 3 or 4 months.
I mean, each researcher.
Each research man.
Right. Yeah, that's another... It was my experience in ORCAM and elastomers is that the research was very closely supervised, and we even wrote weekly summaries when I first came.
We had that too. We had weekly summaries. I think that went out. The supervisor could require it simply as a way of monitoring research from their in a more convenient way. But we had what were called monthly letters that we had to write periodically, and these were intended for higher management, but they were very terse summaries. I think the best way of keeping research going was the oral reports and the so-called PR reports, so that people had to think about what they're doing and summarize their thoughts. And I think this is the best way of bringing home to them the important contributions that they may have made, because you had to put in your summary and conclusions exactly what you did, and that required a good deal of soul searching and say, am I on the right track and am I doing it correctly?
Let's talk a little bit about the Textile Fibers Department major projects, or major polymers and fibers. Did you work on nylon at all when you were?
Very little. Mostly perhaps in a consulting capacity, but I didn't work on nylon.
How about the Dacron polyester fiber?
Very little on that. It was mostly in exploratory work on new fibers.
Okay, then you mentioned Orlon, polyacrylonitrile.
I did work on Orlon, and because Orlon perhaps needed more work. It was the weak sister of the fibers. They wanted better properties, higher molecular, not higher molecular weight, but higher tenacity, higher modulus.
I recall my wife worked on fume discoloration or something like that on Orlon. Was that on Dacron? Maybe,
I don't recall that project.
It was a little specific. It was a quality control problem.
At least, I was usually involved in the really pioneering type of working on new fibers, changing fibers drastically to alter properties. So that I was involved, as I say, with Orlon, but for the most part I was involved in making new polymers, the polyamides, polyesters, new vinyl polymer types. And I worked on some of these.
Were you involved in the linear polyaramid work then? Or?
I worked to some extent with that. I was working on some new spinning systems using anhydrous hydrofluoric acid to dissolve the aramids and spin them, and that was pretty close. I had the idea of making more concentrated solutions in hydrofluoric acid because it was a very much less viscous solvent to start with, so the polymer solution was less viscous, so you could build up a higher concentration without increasing the polymer solution viscosity unduly. The only trouble is when you heated these up with HF in order to get less viscosity, it degraded the polymer. HF degrades the polymer much more than 100% sulfuric. So had this succeeded, I would have also had the same sort of invention that was made with sulfuric acid.
Then you got involved in the melt anisotropic polymers.
Right. The idea was there that if you make the structure stiff enough, but simply introduce substituents, copolymerization, in order to cut down the melting point or make it more amorphous. If it's still linear, it should have the high properties. And I think the linearity of the structure is the more important part than, say, crystallization or perfection of the structure, so that you can achieve the high property simply by having a linear structure, no matter what the nature of the microstructure is, if it's copolymer or it has various substituents, as long as you don't disrupt it so much that it can't form liquid crystalline phases. And so that was the basis of this idea. And the time, the thought was that the solvent separates the molecules and prevents it from three-dimensional crystallization. And if you worked with the neat polymer, why, it's going to crystallize before it will form liquid crystalline phases. If it can get ordered enough to form a liquid crystalline phase, well, it's simply going to crystallize. Fluorine even expressed this idea, tried it anyway, and it worked.
I see. And you have publications or patents in this area?
We have patents, but we never did publish on it. They thought it, they simply refused to have any publications, but there are some publications coming out now, and I'm giving a paper in the symposium we're planning for Princeton, Scanicon, Princeton, in August of this year, when we're going to have an international symposium on ultimate properties of polymers.
I see. You mentioned Fluorine again. Do you recall when Fluorine started back with DuPont as a consultant?
Yeah, I arranged to have him come back, but it was in the 50s sometime, 55 to 60, in that era. At the time he was working at Mellon Institute, he couldn't consult because he was full-time at Mellon Institute. It's a quasi-industrial organization, so he couldn't consult. But after that, he left and went to Cornell, and at that time he started consulting with us.
Well, he was at Mellon before Cornell.
That's right. I wasn't. Did he go to? No, he did go to Cornell.
He went to Cornell.
All right, he did go to Cornell. All right, we must have had him when he was at Cornell, and then he couldn't consult while he was at Mellon. Then he came back at Cornell.
After he left,
he
got to Stanford. He came back.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That clarifies something for me because I had wondered why. As a matter of fact, I don't think he consulted with Central Research very often until recent years.
So. No, he didn't. I don't know why that was.
He was a textile fibers consultant.
Yeah, but he was a textile fibers consultant all the time. But he didn't like to go out to the outlying laboratories because he said there were two applied problems and he didn't feel that it was worth his while. He was very jealous of his time. He didn't have that much, and so he didn't want to consult and feels that he felt he couldn't make a good contribution. He thought it was a waste of their money and his time.
Of course, the truth, Central Research wasn't doing much in polymers in the period of the late 50s to the mid 60s, let's say.
Yeah, that's right, too.
One of the reasons I was invited in as a visitor, and you also, I guess, was that Central Research was becoming aware of the need to do more basic research in polymers because the operating departments, I think, were cutting back.
Right. And they were getting more on the idea of modifying existing polymers to make new products and rather than not making new structures or doing basic research, and that gap had to be filled by someone else, and that was Central Research.
So were you ordinarily Fluorine's host when he came? Or
yes, I was his host until I retired.
I recall seeing you with him many times in the cafeteria and so on. Did you maintain a close personal friendship with Fluorine, or was it?
Yes, we exchanged Christmas cards. We talked, we met frequently. I knew his whole family, wife and children.
How about other consultants that you worked with over the years? Anybody else?
Well, I knew Marvel pretty well too. Acted as his host at times, talked with him.
Did you use Stockmeyer at all?
I have talked to Stockmeyer, yes. And I thought that he's very excellent chemist also. He lacks the breath that Fluorine had.
Just a broad question. By and large, what function did you feel the consultants performed? Were they, in your opinion, about useful to your research?
It's a difficult question to answer. Why don't I speak sort of in general terms that I felt that most people thought that consultants were useful as sounding boards. In other words, you could talk about your ideas and they would tell you whether you were on the right track. Florey, of course, had a very keen insight, and if you were promoting something on the basis of an inadequate theory, he would tell you right off that you just couldn't do this sort of thing. It's impossible. So that consultants did serve a role as a sounding board. They inspired you, too. They had a different viewpoint. They brought in their experience in other fields. So you were inspired talking to them. As far as help on individual projects, you frequently didn't get too much of this because you knew the subject better than they did, and to think that you could bring in something, someone for a day and tell him completely what you're doing and then expect him to make a worthwhile contribution when you had been thinking about it for a long time is just expecting a little too much.
Well, now that you're a consultant, what's the feeling and problems on the other side of the business?
You really ought to ask the people that consult with me, shouldn't you?
Well, I don't know. I'm asking.
I do have I have one advantage. I do keep up with all the work that's going on, so they don't have to fill me in with the background. I have the industrial viewpoint of what they're after and how one goes about it. And so I have that advantage. So I have some advantages over the person coming from a university. I also work a little bit differently. I will read up in areas which I know I'm going to consult on in advance. I will have follow-up work in which I will bring things to their attention. I will think about their problems in between. And so when I come back, I will have some ideas to start out with. Whereas a consultant from a university will come in cold.
Let's see, now, when did you retire, John?
The end of November, 82.
Okay, was that the part of the VTI?
It was the VTI.
Okay,
the first one, right.
Termination incentive
for
the non-DuPonters.
Right. Now, since then, I've been working. I've formed my own consulting company, which I call LJ, for Laura and myself.
Oh, fine. Are you consulting entirely for DuPont, or for...
Well, I consulted for an oil company for a day, but fortunately oil companies have fell on bad times, so I never went back there. I think they dropped the whole research ideas that they were working on. But then I have consulted with a company called SAIC, who had a government contract from NSF to evaluate Japanese technology versus American technology in the field of advanced materials. And I filled a niche with a group of other people, and we're putting out a report in a couple months on our work. And we made an oral report in Washington before a large number of government scientists and administrators.
I see. Well, let's talk about your professional society associations. I know you've been a leader in the American Chemical Society and so on. Did you join the ACS in college or graduate
school? In graduate school. I've been a member for over 40 years.
You'll be approaching the 50-year mark, I
guess. Right. Well, it'll take a few more years.
I recall personally that you were much involved. Let's see, you've been a counselor to the...
Been a counselor. This is my 15th year as a counselor. And I've decided to leave it for younger people, so I'm not running again.
I see.
And I've been on the National Committee on Economic Status for several years, and before that I was on the Professional Relations Committee at the national level, and on several of the subcommittees of that council committee.
You're a member of other societies as well as the ACS?
Well, I've been going to Gordon conferences in Polymers for a number of years, and I was chairman of that conference in 1970.
So over the years you've gone frequently, is every year, or just occasionally to Gordon conferences?
Perhaps on an average of every other year, but recently I've been going every year.
Neither
since I've been chairman, so that's 1970, and I think I've gone on every year, so this is a matter of 16 years, and I've been going to Polymer Conference and a number of times before that.
Have you ever gotten involved in the Winter Gordon Conferences out in California?
I've been out there. Yes, I was out there once, but I didn't get involved in any official capacity.
Is that a little separate from the Gordon Conferences, Summer Gordon Conferences? Or
it is separate. So they elect their own officials, and they run that entirely separately. It's run in the same way. They get fun, and they arrange the program. And the conference chairman is purely on his own. He is responsible for the whole conference, the organization, getting it running.
Okay, how about your local ACS participation?
Locally, I've held the office of treasurer and secretary and chairman of the local section. I was treasurer of the Akron section. I was in Goodyear, and I was secretary and alternate counselor and counselor and chairman of the local section. And I've been on some committees as well.
Has DuPont been supportive of your activities there, or is this something you had to do on your own?
They've been supportive in that they've provided clerical help, and they've covered telephone calls. And I've been working to some extent during working hours on the local section business, so they've been supportive.
Let's talk a little bit about publications and publication policy. You had got a good year. Were you encouraged to publish, or was it mainly Florey's?
Florey encouraged people to publish. I don't think Goodyear was care. They were sort of passive on the subject. So Florey published almost everything that he could publish at the time. So there it was, a wide open policy of publication. DuPont, of course, is different. They have a reviewing system, and anything that has any potential commercial value had to be withheld. And we have so many operating departments that are interested in polymers that any of them can withhold publication, so that the publication rules that you have to satisfy are simply more and more difficult to fulfill, and there's more editing of what you publish, so that it's much more difficult at DuPont to publish.
Did this you find this inhibiting? Did it discourage you from publishing?
No, not really. I tried. If you didn't succeed, well, you had to accept it and went on. The thing that's most difficult is that you find that if you start something and do some work, other people will get in on it. They do notice patents that come out, and so when you get around to having publications cleared, you find that most of the things that you want to publish have already been done by somebody else. And this is a little bit difficult to accept. But you're being paid to put forth innovations and to do the work, and so that you have to accept that if you wanted to publish freely, well, you don't go to industry, you go to university.
In the end, do you feel that DuPont, say, rewarded people for publishing, or was this considered to be, is it a negative or a positive, let's say?
I think it's neutral. I don't know. I thought that Stephanie Kwolek has achieved a good deal of honor and, you know, in her field, and I don't think that she's received the same sort of treatment from the company. I think she should have been promoted.
She did too. Yeah. She should have been promoted much sooner, I think.
I think so. I think you're right.
I think looking at Stephanie, who had only a bachelor's degree, she has achieved considerable recognition and distinction.
Yeah, that's right. And
so, well, that'll be a question for me to ask her when I interview her.
Yeah. I think it's pretty much neutral. If there's a question on the fence, I think someone that has achieved a reputation outside the company might gain value from this, you know. So,
talking about professionalism, I might raise a thought that I've often had. I frequently felt that internally within the company, many of our outstanding people were not as well recognized and within the DuPont company as they were among their peers in the outside scientific community. Did you ever have that feeling?
Oh, somewhat, but it wasn't really that important, because I think people were recognized within the company too if they did work that was worthy of publication. Well, just the very fact that if you do publish and you do conduct meetings and you're active in society affairs, it shows a competence that should be recognized within the company too. It shows a degree of leadership. It shows a degree of scientific competence that has to be recognized. And someone that publishes and is subject to a reviewing system other than within DuPont has to be more careful in what he does, have a higher degree of competence than many of the things that are published within the company. So I think it's worthwhile. That idea was even expressed by some of the higher people in the central research in a series that I had in the Dell Chem Bulletin some years ago, where I asked certain questions, and I think it was Cairns at the time who thought that someone who published outside and was subject to peer review system and was able to do it showed a competence beyond the person that only publishes within the company.
I see. Well, it's probably a good time to ask a broad question, whether you have any particular feelings about professionalism, changes in the professional status of chemists, or the approach of chemists to their work from the time you were starting out to the present time. Any profound or significant changes you see?
Are you talking about changes that should be made, or
well,
that
maybe
are being made?
Maybe a little specifically first about perhaps the support for and changes in research policy, let's say in an industrial company, DuPont in particular.
Well, at present, there have been a great deal, a great deal of work, many inventions made in the field of chemistry from the time when I started, and so the need to become even more inventive and more innovative even stronger today. A number of inventions have been made, so the field that's available is not as great, and so you have to have to give more freedom to the individual chemist to do his own work. I don't think that you can direct research in the way you did previously. You don't have the number of projects that have to be manned and development work in specific directions given. So we have to allocate more funds to innovative work and continue it for a longer time. I think if we don't, we're going to run afoul of foreign competition, such as they have in Japan and Germany and other countries, where they will show more persistence in a given field, more work to achieve success. We tend to go into something, and if it doesn't succeed in 6 months, to drop it. And I think the time is coming when we'll have to devote more time to it, encourage people to do more individual work and to exercise their greatest ingenuity in order to be competitive in innovative research. And innovative research is where we're going to keep ahead of foreign competition. If you look at the Nobel Prize winners in the U.S. versus other countries, if you look at the number of inventions made, significant inventions, where they've been made in the U.S. for the most part. And that has kept us ahead, because when you come to applied research, the cheap foreign work, the foreign research is cheaper to carry out. They're going to beat us economically in this field all the time. But we can stay ahead innovatively because we have the system here of encouraging people to be innovative from the universities on. We have to maintain